Recording.
Thank you.
Still be there to answer that. Pretty well set up. Let me see.
Let's see what it's like.
Yeah. It's weird because you can't see anything going on unless you look on the screen.
Right.
You're just totally, like a camera.
You're much closer then. When you're sitting back there, it kind of seems like we're very far away from people sitting at the table, and it's like
You're right here.
there's like, yeah, it's not as much of a difference as I thought.
Exactly.
It kind of looks like they like lord over you, and don't
Well,
really,
it's like being in a courtroom
yeah.
is, the best way to look at it. Which even back in the old days when I was working in Tennessee, a lot of these rural counties, they called their county commission the county court,
Oh.
which was an old, very old term for the commission, because they were like, we're holding court, meaning,
Yeah.
it's kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Since, like, we're going to county court, and I was, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
Heard that.
Sounds serious.
Exactly. Well, did they know? Yeah, we should be. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Chairs are much more comfortable up here than down there. Maybe I should have agreed with that.
Oh,
Because those like old bowling alley chairs are bad. They should definitely
I
think about
know.
updating them.
I guess we all get it. The dais is the same chairs as that council has, but I mean, councils have the time they're sitting here in study session anyway, so of course they would. Yeah, I think we're in good shape.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
I know. I was going to wait another half hour. Here we are.
That?
Okay, we'll just work on one screen. But we saw the storm coming in. We're like, oh,
Oh, I
never mind.
know. I
That's how I
know.
felt.
That's why I came straight here instead of
Not planning on
staying.
staying up here. I just wanted to see
You
what
can
it's
stay
like.
up here. I think.
Yeah,
Do you
thanks.
want to talk about landscape? I know it's super late in the game. You don't have to.
I will do whatever you tell me. I was.
Don't want to throw that at you. No matter how painful it might be to me. No, but I think at the public hearing, if you want to.
I mean, part of
Yeah.
sitting
Yes.
in the seat.
Thank you.
probably know it better than.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, and I can probably present on it too. Even I haven't like looked at it, but
I won't throw you in
I
the
did
under the
reading
bus.
into fact. I'm
Yeah.
confident, completely confident about it. These chairs are way better than the old bowling alley chairs back there. So
Oh
in
yeah.
some ways it is like very nice, but I'd rather like take notes quietly in the back and not be on camera the whole time.
Just gonna print
Me
this
too.
out before we left.
Okay.
Did you because I didn't print something or needed to update and I just asked Francisco to print it. Do you have something that you need to
I was
print?
just gonna print the presentation
Oh,
so I have it in
okay.
front of me.
Have it in front of you.
Yeah.
Okay. You may be able to ask your mics on. Is that
You want accept.
Hello? I think it's working.
Hello.
There we go. That's good.
In those parties.
That was a lot. And then we had a dinner party with, we had several groups of friends who had all, oh, we got to get together for dinner. Oh, we got to get together for dinner.
All right. Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the City of Tucson Planning Commission. My name is Chris Ortiz-Pino, and I am the chair of the Planning Commission. The responsibilities of this body are to advise the mayor and council and the Planning and Development Services Department on the adoption of long-range plans, policies, specific plans, and regulations that affect land use and development. Full staff, please call roll.
Certainly. Vice Chair Kinney. Commissioner Lampo. Commissioner Lane?
Present.
Commissioner McKenzie?
Present.
Chair Ortiz-Pino?
Present.
Commissioner Silva? Commissioner Small?
Present.
Commissioner Walczak?
Here.
Commissioner Wellett?
Present.
Commissioner Young? And Commissioner Zagier?
Here.
Great. Does the record reflect that a quorum is present?
Excellent. I would now call for the next item, number two, approval of the legal action report from August 13th, 2025. Do I have a motion?
Chair, I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve the minutes.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor of those approving legal action report from August 13, 2025, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Hearing no, motion passes. A favorable recommendation of the major streets and routes plan and map update from the Planning Commission will be sent to the Mayor and Council. Okay, call for our next item, number three, major streets and routes plan update study session. Middle housing. I think I got the wrong.
Yeah.
Here I am just reading exactly what I've been given.
So item number three is the middle housing code amendment.
Item number three session. Middle housing code amendment. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, Commission. Thanks for joining us for this Planning Commission study session on middle housing. Middle housing was born from House Bill 2721 from the state of Arizona, which applies to cities of greater than 75,000 residents. So Tucson's very well within that. And it requires regulations allowing middle housing, which is defined as anywhere from 2 to 4 units on all lots that allow for single family homes within 1 mile of the central business district, and at least 20% of new developments of greater than 10 acres. And that's typically those larger subdivision sites. So middle housing would be required to be allowed on 20% of those sites.
Nick, may I please interrupt you? Can we get some sound equalization back here? We're getting kind of blasted.
Yeah. Is it too loud? I can.
It's coming from the speakers. Yeah, it's a lot.
Is it better if I talk from here?
A little bit. I think it's some balancing that's got to happen back there.
Okay. Is that better? A little better?
It's still coming from our boxes. I don't know if we necessarily need that. Can we turn off the? What are we calling these things? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little intense. It wasn't you. It's the box.
I'm yelling through the box. Yes.
Maybe it's
That might be better. Is it just better if I sit further away, like that? Yeah. Okay. If worst case scenario, we can just do that. My wife tells me the same thing every time I talk. Okay, we're good with that? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so picking up off that, so the rules cannot be stricter than those of single family homes within the city of Tucson right now. And then these regulations need to be adopted by January 1st, 2026, or else this becomes valid citywide. So when we're talking about middle housing types, we have a number of middle housing types already in Tucson. We have duplexes, we have tri and fourplexes, townhomes and cottage courts, all things that are legal to be built in Tucson and things that are out throughout the city already. Some of the goals of middle housing are adding housing choices to meet income and generational needs, to build community with closer neighbors, shared supportive living spaces, support Tucson's climate action goals and some of the plans that have already been adopted in the city of Tucson. And then through the use of efficient city infrastructure and transit projects, and then create more convenient, walkable communities, bringing people closer to their destinations, and then make it easier for local businesses to thrive in more populated areas. So I do want to point out that we already have some tools in the city of Tucson for the building of middle housing. Many zones already allow 2 to 4 units to be built on those lots. For instance, the R1 unit already does allow for 2 units if you have 10,000 square feet, and the R1 is not a very permissible zone in terms of building housing. The R2 allows 15 units per acre, so you could build middle housing on those lots already. There's also the very popular flexible lot development, which is for building of subdivisions by providing extra functional open space or other community amenities in exchange for smaller lot sizes and more flexible development standards. We've also recently passed the accessory dwelling units, which are allowed on all residential lots throughout the city already. So you can already add extra housing to a lot with a unit already on it. And same with the single family attached land use in the residential land use category. You can already do smaller lot sizes if you attach them or create some sort of townhome. And then some of the parking updates that we've done over the past few years with the code cleanups already allow you to not have to do a full vehicle use area if you're doing small middle housing developments. And that would be decreased parking, smaller parking access area, access lanes, curbing, and all of those types of amenities. We also want to point out that these align with some of the already adopted plans that have already been through a public process in the city, including the PCHIP plan adopted in 2025, which goal is to increase affordable and attainable housing options. And I'll get into the affordability aspect of it here in a minute. Tucson Norte Sur, which initiates development along a transit-oriented development that's in progress right now. And then the Prosperity Initiative, which seeks to increase housing and mobility opportunities across the city. Also, it kind of relates to Plan Tucson, which has several housing policies, including increasing access to safe and healthy and affordable housing choices, promoting affordable housing, encouraging residential development. And so these are things that have already gone through a public process that we are going to try to build on when we're making this code change. In terms of middle housing and affordability, we found recently with some research that creating middle housing does increase affordability. So over 35,000 new housing units are already needed in Tucson right now. As of 2023, only 38% of homes were available to median income families in Tucson, and we have some statistics on that. Middle housing also expands choices for middle income families being priced out of current housing stock. And then by allowing more housing options at various price points, middle housing can help reduce competition for lower cost affordable housing units. And I'll show you a graphic here. And then shared land and simpler construction. So reducing the cost per unit by having smaller homes, smaller lot sizes, just providing an extra housing type that you don't see built a lot in the city right now. So this is what I was referring to with some of the housing formats. A lot of the times with condos and townhomes, that's really aimed at that 80 to 120% AMI, which is about $61,000 to $92,000 annually for a household of 2 people. And then a small detached single unit being a little bit bigger than a middle housing, it's kind of aimed at that 120% to 150% AMI. That's a $92,000 to $115,000 annually for 2-person household. So you kind of see those smaller units, those attached, those townhomes, they kind of get at that that missing area when it comes to housing affordability for middle income. And then, of course, you see some of the large detached single units, which are 200% AMI and more. And then casitas, which generally are in that 80 to 100% AMI. So the point of it is that the more housing types you have, the more affordable it becomes to different incomes. We're also seeing, and we did, Eco Northwest did some research on this recently too. We're also seeing that there's a pretty big need in the city of Tucson for housing, especially at that, for the subsidized affordable housing from that 0 to 60%. AMI, and also a huge need at that greater than 120% AMI. So what you're seeing, if you don't provide what's in the middle where there might not be as much of a demand, those seeking that 120% or those in that 120% AMI area will go and get the houses that are in the middle housing area or that kind of mid-income area, not leaving enough housing for those of middle income. And so providing this need reduces competition for housing at a lower price point. So there's some additional House Bill 2721 minimum requirements as well. So within the downtown area, middle and single family housing must follow the same procedures and standards. And then commercial standards now have to apply to 5+ units instead of 3+ units. Right now in the city, if you're building 3 or more units, it's considered a commercial multifamily use. That has to change through this middle housing bill to comply with the state. We have to allow for 2-story units to be built. Parking can be no more than 1 off-street spot per unit, which is pretty in line with our Unified Development Code already. And then some definitions need some changing, like household, single family attached, and likely others. We'll also have to make a couple building code alignments just to make sure that those building middle housing can still use the International Residential Code. And then there's going to be some minor changes to large area developments, like I was talking about, some of those subdivision sites. They will need to be able to build middle housing as well. I do want to touch a lot on what is currently allowed and what the House Bill 2721 requirements will require. So I want to point out that in the R1, you can already do a single family home and you can already do townhomes. Same with the R2, R3. And then commercial and office zones. You can already do this in the city of Tucson. The R1, you can already do 2 units if you have a larger lot. Same with the R2, R3 in commercial and office. It's when we start getting into the triplex and fourplex that really starts changing. So right now you cannot do a triplex or a fourplex in an R1, and you will be able to with the middle housing. With the R2s, R3s, and some of those higher density, you can already do multifamily. You can already do triplex and fourplex. So there's not a lot that's actually going to be changing with the code and what's allowed in these zones, but there will be some changes to how many units you can do on a lot. And so that number for the R1 is going to change from 3 to 4. And then some of those higher density areas, they're going to vary a little bit. So we kicked this off by attending a mayor and council study session April 22nd to talk about House Bill 2721 and some of the requirements. Mayor and council directed staff to explore more flexible development standards like height, light setbacks, and minimum lot size. They also directed staff to apply or look and bring to the public applying middle housing rules to a wider geography than is required by the state. And then to look into some design standards for landscaping, pedestrian circulation, go to the public and see what the opinions were on design standards within the city. And then a phased approach to allow for review and modification of standards over time. So maybe increasing that geography as time goes on after we get a chance to see what kind of middle housing has been built and how things have been going with the implementation of the new code. So that led us to our code development, which was phase one. This was something that we ultimately brought to the public. In this code proposal, we, one, defined what middle housing was and what the middle housing area would look like. We have a few different examples of what we showed to the public, and then putting it into a land use category. We looked at adding site standards like landscape, circulation, building design. We looked into parking requirements. We looked at how we could change applying commercial standards to 5+ units instead of the 3+ units I was referring to earlier. And then expanding the landscape rules to all infill. So any lot that's building 1 to 4 units would have to adhere to these landscape standards, which I'll get into here. And then we also started developing what requiring larger subdivisions to do with regard to building housing. So this is the different geographies that we were looking at when we brought this to the public. So when the House Bill 2721 references the Central Business District and us being required to expand this 1 mile from the Central Business District, the city does not have one single Central Business District that we can go from. So we used a few different areas. So the Rio Nuevo area, the Infill Incentive District, the Central Business District, and the Business Incentive District to kind of find where that 1 mile barrier or buffer could be and what it could look like. And so we brought the public a few different options using some of these maps. And we kind of started tweaking. You can kind of see up here where some of these radiuses ended up. We looked at a few different options in an effort to not cut off neighborhoods or cut in the middle of arterial streets. We came up with a Norte Sur area, which kind of follows the Tucson Norte Sur adopted plan, and then goes about east to Country Club, which is something that we were building off of. So we brought the public a few different geographic options to look at, including that Norte Sur area. We also worked pretty closely with the Trockman Institute and continue to do so about looking at some of the site configurations when it comes to either maintaining our current development standards. So that's using our same setbacks, our same lot size, and seeing how feasible it would be for homeowners or applicants to build middle housing. And we found that through providing some flexibility with those dimensional standards, so decreasing setbacks, decreasing minimum lot size, providing a little bit extra flexibility, it actually gave us a little bit more room to work with when it comes to what could be built on some of these middle housing lots. So some of the phase one considerations that we took to the public were one, a minimum landscaping requirement. So we started with a one tree requirement, a five shrub requirement, and then dust proofing ground cover that would be required to be irrigated. We heard about, or we presented the public the option of having wall or fence material standards, shared driveways for homes with multiple units. And then we also brought options about parking or having shaded parking. There were also options to do housing design like coloring, detailing, front entry architectural features, and then materials such as like having no reflective surfaces or something that looks good on a facade. So when we presented that all to the public, we had quite a good turnout. As you can see, we had people identify themselves and who they were representing. 66% of the people that we went to in May for our first round of public meetings said they represented themselves or were as a resident. 19% said that they were housing professionals, and then 15% were other professionals. So through these three meetings, one in person and two online, we had about 360 participants with 500 plus comments. We had a good mix of that, like I showed you here, we had a good mix of residents, businesses, advocates, and design professionals. And we found that there was broad support for more flexibility, a wider geography, and then even citywide applicability. So when we asked the people what they wanted, this is kind of what we came up with. When it came to the where, we heard the majority of people said they wanted this applied to the largest area possible. The how, they wanted a lot of flexibility added in terms of our dimensional standards. And then in terms of design, a lot of people wanted desert landscaping and more pedestrian circulation to ensure a better design. We want to touch a little bit on some of the key themes from our public feedback, just to make sure that we're addressing everyone's concerns. Some of the key themes included code flexibility, so support for flexible dimensional standards to make middle housing more feasible, some neighborhood and historic preservation concerns. So there was concerns about the impacts on character and historic districts, and I'm going to get into that a little bit more detail. There's concerns about parking. Those were pretty split. Some thought it was too much parking. Some thought it wasn't enough parking. Landscape standards, there was a worry about adding additional costs to development. And then enforcement, so not ensuring that that trees didn't die from lack of watering, and then a lack of flexibility with some of our proposed landscape standards. There were concerns about affordability and the concern that investors would come and demolish homes just to build middle housing. And then there were, of course, concerns about geography and equity. There was a debate about limiting the area or going a little bit more and actually going to a citywide applicability. So I wanted to get a little bit more granular with the historic preservation concerns because this is something we've heard a lot of. So in terms of what we can do with historic preservation and neighborhood preservation, so NPZs, sorry, neighborhood preservation zone, yeah. So all historic requirements will still remain the same. We're not going to change anything regarding the requirements. All sites still have to go through the same historic review process. And then it turns out many historic zones have typically already allowed for middle housing, and we find that middle housing is already built on a lot of historic properties. With regard to National Register of Historic Districts, staff are proposing expanding the middle housing area to help decrease some of the pressure on some of those closer to downtown areas. So right now, if we had just stuck with that minimum geography as required by the state, that would be mostly in those historic zones. A lot of those historic zones in downtown would be the only ones being allowed to build middle housing. And then based on some Drachman Institute research, more flexibility with dimensional standards can disincentivize demolitions if that was a concern. So being able to have smaller setbacks helps you fit in more housing, kind of decreasing that need for a demolition or decreasing the desire for demolition, I would say. And then the scale of middle housing development is generally in the context of existing neighborhoods. And the development of this type is usually incremental and doesn't lead to wholesale neighborhood change immediately. So we've kind of seen that with the CCT when it was adopted. We haven't seen a huge influx of CCT come into the same areas in a neighborhood and change. Oh, and same with the ADUs. We haven't seen a lot of those ADUs come in and just start changing the face of a neighborhood. So it's been more incremental that we've seen with some of our permit data. And then ultimately, staff cannot legally prohibit demolitions or restrict the delisting of contributing properties. So with all that public feedback, we went back to Mayor and Council in June of this year. We held a study session with Mayor and Council, and they directed us to continue to look at more flexible development standards like height, setbacks, minimum lot size. They also directed us to apply the middle housing rules to the established Norte Sur area, which was a popular one among the people that we polled. And so I can go back to that map if you all'd like to see it again. And then look at the design standards for landscaping and more pedestrian circulation between middle housing units. And then to ultimately look at a phased approach to allow for review of what we've done with middle housing so far, and then start modifying it as time goes on. So continue to look at what's being built and how we can reshape it a little bit. So a little overview of the proposed amendment. The first thing, so there's going to be a change to when you can use the building code because the state is restricting us from requiring the building code to be used for 3 and 4 units. An applicant would now be allowed to opt in and use the International Residential Code, which was typically used for 1 and 2 units only. So now for middle housing, they'd be able to use it up to 4 units. So commercial standards are going to have to change from the 3+ units I was talking about to 5+ units now. New landscape requirements apply to all new infill of 1 to 4 units across the city to remain consistent with what we're requiring for middle housing. And then middle housing is added as a new residential land use with reduced setbacks, reduced minimum lot size, an option to waive parking if you're within a certain distance from an enhanced bike route or a public transit stop, and then privacy mitigation requirements to kind of mitigate some of those reduced setbacks. And then, of course, those large subdivisions now have to allow for middle housing on 20% of their residential lots. So just a quick overview of some of the changes before I get into each one of them. We're looking at where middle housing can be built. We're looking at residential density up to 4 units on middle housing lots. We're looking at a smaller lot size for all zones within the middle housing area, changes to interior setbacks, changes to required parking, changes to group dwelling definitions in certain zones, and I'll get into that a little bit, and then required landscape, and then the allowing for middle housing in those larger subdivisions. So one, we created a new residential use called middle housing, which is a building or buildings with 2 to 4 dwelling units on a site, including townhomes. Commissioner Kinney, I will probably take into your comments into consideration and call it attached instead of just townhomes, excluding accessory dwelling units. And so this is the area that Mayor and Council asked us to explore after the feedback that we heard on the Tucson Norte Sur Country area, Country Club area, or now referred to as the middle housing area. We are looking into where middle housing is allowed and some specific standards that pertain to middle housing. Middle housing is going to be permitted in all zones that allow for single family homes within that middle housing area. So that's almost every zone except for some industrial areas. So that includes office and commercial zones as well. And then some of the standards. So we're proposing a privacy mitigation required for multi-story units within 10 feet of a single story unit neighboring them. And what that would look like is no balconies or standard windows facing those lots. Clerestory windows and privacy mitigated windows would be fine. And then a proposed parking of 1 space per unit with that waiver that I mentioned a minute ago. Looking at density and minimum lot size, so middle housing is going to consist of 2 to 4 units, and they would be allowed on those single family lots. We've gotten a lot of community feedback that support more flexibility for those middle housing units. So for instance, the R1, the MH1, and the O1 zone would go from 7,000 square feet minimum lot size down to 6,000 square feet, resulting in just less than 1,000 square feet of change. The R2, MH2, and O2 zones would be going from 5,000 to 4,000. And then we propose the R3 and O3 go down from 5 to 3,000, although we did receive some feedback on that. So with the increased density up to 4 units, so we would also propose that increased density up to 4 units if you're within that middle housing area that I showed you just now. In terms of the minimum lot size and lot splits, we heard a lot of feedback about the public wanting more options for different housing types and different ownership models, as opposed to just having 4 units on the same lot. So that was kind of the approach of reducing our minimum lot size by 1,000 square feet. And we actually came up with some really interesting results here. For the R1, the R2, and the R3, by decreasing the minimum lot size by 1,000, that opened up 1,781 additional lots within that area that would have not been able to build middle housing because they would have been non-conforming lot sizes. And so that actually opened up quite a few different possibilities when it comes to people adding more middle housing in that smaller area. We also found that by decreasing the lot size by 1,000 square feet in the R1, R2, R3 zones alone, this is not even talking about the O zones or the C zones, 2,465 additional lots could potentially be eligible to split their lots with that decrease. So for instance, if you had previously a 11,000 square foot lot, I'm sorry, a 9,000 square foot lot in the R2 zone, you would not have been able to split that and build middle housing. You would have had to put middle housing only on that R2 lot. Now with that decrease, you could split a 9,000 square foot R2 lot into two different lots, and you could build middle housing on them. So it opened up quite a few more lots that would be eligible to have middle housing on them. So in our code, we wrote in those decreases in minimum lot size. We also wanted to come at you all with an option to look at minimum lot size through the lens of a density requirement, as opposed to just simply a minimum lot size requirement. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how we define the use of site in the Unified Development Code. So when somebody, a city reviewer, is looking at a site, it's considered a site when there are shared features like driveways, walkways, access, common space. And so this is a really good example, this site plan right here, of a multifamily unit that was split into two. So it's still operating as one multifamily unit. It's still operating as one site because they have that shared driveway, they have the shared parking, they have a cross-access easement, and they have some shared amenities like the landscaping you can see to the south. So one option is to, for minimum lot size based on residential density, is to have a lot split option where you can utilize the density for two smaller lots. So that would look like, for example, if you had a 5,000 square foot lot, you could split that lot into two lots and have two units on them each. This gets really complex. And that could be two 2,500 square foot lots. It would allow you to establish that as a site with that lot split. So shared amenities like driveways, parking, landscape, access, shared site features, and then you could have those two houses on each lot. It would still result in four units on within that 5,000 square feet, but it would just be split into two lots that operate as one site. There's another option for a subdivision, which could utilize the density for four smaller lots. Again, it would be the same number of lots on a site, but it would enable you to then split those into 1,500 square foot lots with a smaller house on each. It would still operate as a site. It would require a subdivision. It would require all the same amenities and the site review requirements as a subdivision, but you would have access between the four different lots operating as one single site. And again, those would have shared site features like landscape, like pedestrian circulation. And then you would have the ability for one house on each of those lots. Again, looking at some of the research that the Drachman Institute helped us with, they did a little bit of research on, and it's kind of small on this screen. They did a little bit of research on smaller housing types fitting into smaller lots. And so it's really hard to tell. So you can see on the right side, essentially what you could fit onto a smaller lot would be essentially a smaller home. And this would just give you a little bit more flexibility to build some of those smaller homes on smaller lots, giving people the opportunity for more home ownership opportunities, which was something that we heard a lot when we took this to the public. A couple other things that we need to talk about, some changes to dimensional and other standards. So we are proposing that reduction in the side and rear setbacks from a variable setback to a standard 5-foot setback. Right now with our Unified Development Code, there are requirements for basing your setback off of how tall the building is. Right now we're proposing that on those side and rear lots, a 5-foot setback, which would just be standard. And some of that reason, like I mentioned earlier, is we've found that by requiring smaller setbacks like that, it kind of de-incentivizes some of those possible demolitions that could just raise a site just for the building of middle housing. It could allow you to fit a few more homes on a site or another home on a site where you would not have been able to otherwise. So it just gives you a little bit more flexibility when it comes to adding more housing units. Because of that, we're also proposing privacy mitigation. So if adjacent to a one-story building, then you would have to have of a more restrictive zone. You would not be able to have balconies or windows facing that, and then you could have some clerestory windows. So giving a little bit of privacy mitigation in return for that smaller 5-foot setback. Again, those changes to the multifamily threshold will need to go from 3 to 5 units. We'll have to allow for middle housing in subdivisions, and then we'll need to make those changes to the building to when you can use the International Residential Code. We also made some proposals for landscape in our phase two of the public outreach. So we took this to the public. And what we're proposing is one tree per 1,000 square feet of gross floor area. Existing trees will count in this scenario. Half of them would need to be placed in the front yard, and there would be a shrub substitution for site constraints if a tree would not fit in that landscape area. We're also proposing a ground cover requirement. There would be a 5-foot strip along the street frontage minus curb cuts placed anywhere in the front yard of ground cover. So small lots can use alternative locations. Irregular lots can measure parallel to the street frontage. So if you have a flag lot, you would still measure the full frontage of the street between the two lots. For regular shaped lots, that would happen. And then for smaller lots, we would have alternative locations available. A distancing requirement from utilities, structures, and sidewalks, depressed planting area around trees. We propose a flexible watering requirement. So instead of irrigation, there would just be a watering requirement. And then plants must be low to very low water use, a hardiness rating below 15 degrees, and be from the ADWR's plant list. So some landscaping code proposed exceptions. So expansions of existing residential projects would be exempt if you already have that. The tree there. Accessory dwelling units would not be subject to the same landscape requirements. Projects with 5+ units would still be considered multifamily and would have to adhere to multifamily commercial landscaping requirements. And then middle housing built through subdivisions of 8 lots or more would have to adhere to the current subdivision standards that are already in place. And then flexible lot developments also have their own landscape requirements. So when we took this to the public for our round 2 of public engagement, this was just a few weeks ago in August, we had 193 attendees. Again, we had a really good mix of people there when it came to building professionals or design professionals or just homeowners or community members. We had 450 plus comments this time around, and we left that comment open for comment from August 17th to September 7th. So we could kind of gather some of that information. And again, it was very similar. We had a general sentiment for more flexibility and desire for a larger geographic applicability, even a citywide option. So this is something we've continued to hear as this desire for a citywide option. There was also support for that home ownership model. This was something we heard a lot in our last couple meetings, not just for renting, having 4 units on 1 lot, but to have some of those smaller lot size options to kind of get at some of those different area median incomes that I spoke on a little bit earlier. We also heard a lot of those concerns about the National Register of Historic Districts that I spoke on earlier as well. So some of the public meeting feedback details we saw in terms of the middle housing area, a lot of people, more people thought that it was too small and needed to be larger. We got a really good mixed feedback when it came to use specific standards. More people thought this was too restrictive and needed to be a little bit more flexible. We heard quite a bit of different opinions on that. And then for the dimensional standards, option 3, which was to both make a minimum lot size and that density minimum lot size work, that was the most popular one. In terms of dimensional standards feedback, people felt it was too restrictive and needed to be a little bit more flexible. And then for landscape, we also heard that it felt a little too restrictive and needed some more flexibility. Although we did hear quite a bit of mixed opinions about every single one of these. So some code amendments, some small changes we made because of that feedback. We changed our R3 and O3 from 3,000, the decrease from by 2,000. We just went to the 4,000, which was in line with everything decreasing by 1,000 square feet. And so now the R3 and O3 minimum lot size would be 4,000 square feet. And then we added this option for you all to consider a minimum lot size to match the density. In terms of landscape code, we made some clarification about the ground cover formula and then regarding where curb cuts would be and then the placement of where that ground cover could be, leaving it a little bit more flexible to place it when there are site constraints. We address irregular lot sizes, the water use and hardiness specifications that we added to the code, And then we clarified that irrigation was not a requirement, but we made that more clear and clarified the language to watering requirements. And then we also made a clarification about when commercial standards would apply. So some additional public feedback that we got from that second round, there were concerns about the elimination of single family zoning. While the code changes do allow for more density within the proposed middle housing area, there are multiple tools that already allow for middle housing across the street, across the city. And then concerns about building of duplexes for renters. This is something we've seen with some of the feedback we've gotten in the last few days. All zones where single family homes are permitted already allow for a second unit, whether it's a second unit by right or an accessory dwelling unit. Adding a second unit can address affordability, and splitting lots can add more purchasable units throughout the city. There were some concerns about whether how this would interfere with overlays. Middle housing standards do not supersede overlays, and some of those would be the airport districts, hillside or scenic areas. So middle housing would not supersede those standards. And then there were concerns about infrastructure capacity. So we are proposing no changes to infrastructure upgrades. You still have to go through the same process. And we have not seen wholesale changes in communities being overhauled like that. And so these have been incremental changes, particularly with ADUs. We have not seen these wholesale changes that have changed neighborhoods. A couple future considerations. So the city has a grant from HUD called the Pro Housing Grant, which will help us expand our model plan library, something we already have for ADUs, but this is something we like to see expanded for middle housing options. So being able to have a library of homes that could be permitted that would be less expensive, that somebody could purchase a pre-approved building plan. And then some, hopefully being able to provide some technical assistance and capacity building for small scale developers building middle housing. And then some future code amendments. So we want to monitor the outcomes and evaluate this to a citywide expansion at some point. So this is something we want to keep an eye on, monitor how the code changes are going, see what's being built, see what tweaks we need to make. Track development patterns and maybe look at some of those unintended consequences or unintended impacts of middle housing, and then engage the public in phase two reforms for broader middle housing adoption. And part of the reason why we're not proposing to go citywide at this point is because we've already looked at the Norte Sur area, something that's already been adopted. We've done some public outreach to the neighborhoods that would be affected or not affected, that would be in that middle housing area already. And then we feel that expanding citywide would require us to do a little bit more research, a little bit more outreach to the public, and then being able to monitor how middle housing is being built once it's implemented. And just not even to mention that this is going beyond the minimum that the state requires. The state's only requiring us to go 1 mile from that central business district. We've decided to expand that, propose more dimensional flexibility, and propose some site amenities that look like a better product, especially at the from some of the things that we've heard from the public and mayor and council. So our staff recommendation is staff recommends the Planning Commission set a public hearing for the middle housing code amendments for October 15th, 2025.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your presentation, Nicholas. That was great. Go ahead and open this up to discussion, questions, and all right. Commissioner Wellett, you got the floor.
Awesome. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Nick, for such a good presentation. And I really want to applaud staff on all the effort you guys have done and navigating all of the different public comments. I mean, I personally attended a number of those sessions, and just the balancing act you guys do, I really want to appreciate you all for that. So thank you. First thing I want clarification on is the notion of, you know, what the state statute suggests as it relates to the 20% of residential units on the lot. So can you guys clarify for me, the state is suggesting that we must allow for the opportunity, not that we must require. Is that correct?
Thanks, Commissioner Willett. That is correct. So they just have to have the opportunity to build middle housing on 20% of their lots. There's no requirement for them to build it. And it's just a small change to our administrative manual, just allowing it.
Okay.
But what does that mean?
I got more. Let me get there. Hold on. So let me get there. So I got some clarification before I get to the how I think we can clarify it a little bit. The other question I wanted to ask, so the state statute suggests on properties more than 10 acres. Is that 10 acres? Is that 10.01 acres? Is it 11? What is the more than 10 acres?
The state statute, Commissioner Wallet, thanks for the question. The state statute just said 10 plus acres. So we are going with any site that is 10 or more acres would be required.
And that's what I thought. And I just wanted to get to this point of clarification. So on page 18, item 11, we clearly define it in that capacity. We say that it's in this geographical boundary and middle housing is also permitted up to 20% of lots in new residential subdivisions. So when we say new residential subdivisions, is it always a subdivision or is it not subdivided whatsoever and it's just a site?
Commissioner, well, the way I read that, when it says 20% of residential lots within a subdivision, I would take that as a subdivision and not necessarily like a 10-acre lot that is just one lot. Because it says 20% of units of lots within a subdivision, then I would take that as just subdivisions.
Okay, perfect. Fast forward to where we talk about adding the notes in the on the development package or the plat itself. We say, if a gross area of a site is greater than 10 contiguous acres, so here I feel it should say if a site is 10 acres or greater, because it's implying that it must be 10.01. And then we say 20% of lots must allow for middle housing. What if we just suggested rather than that last, the 20% of lots must allow, we suggested something to the effect of for sites with a gross area of 10 contiguous acres or greater, middle housing is permitted on or within 20% of the site area or lots within that subdivision, so that it's very clear that it is an option and not a requirement. Because the way I read it with must allow suggests in my mind that it is required in any subdivision, as opposed to it's just a flexibility option that you can provide in your subdivisions there.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner. Well, that's a good point. And that's something we can clean up some of that language to make it a little bit clearer.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I appreciate that. So you clarified my note on residential subdivision there. I'm going to leave it at that because I think there's probably more on this topic of clarification, perhaps. And I'd rather us move through each topic sequentially. So I'm going to stop there and I'll chime in as we move through the discussion.
Commissioner McKenzie.
Thank you. My question is not on a clarification, but on a broader point, which is that I noticed in the Drochman Institute report, I read the executive summary that, you know, there have been other ways to build middle housing in this in the city, but they're not being built, right? So my question is, has anyone sort of attempted to determine what the impact of this code and this state requirement is on the return on investment for middle housing? Because that's really the crux of the matter, isn't it? I mean, there's not enough return on investment, so they're not getting built. So what does this do in some marginal sense to improve the return on investment?
Commissioner McKenzie, ultimately we haven't done that research and I haven't seen that research done by any other municipality or anybody else in the state at this point, as far as what that impact would be. It is something we can kind of take a look at as far as like what the feasibility is and what there might be additional barriers that we can reduce related to this. And it's something that we will be potentially looking at with our pro housing grant. As far as, you know, we can make the changes to the zoning to allow for this, especially related to infill. And I think that's what the main goal of a lot of this is. But I think there's other tools, financial tools. There's other, you know, things related to maybe building code policies that we could look at. You know, I know there were a lot of comments related to kind of shared utilities, which is something we're looking at as well as a potential for this. So I think there are additional ways just beyond zoning that we can potentially look at, and we really are planning to utilize that pro housing grant to look at a lot of those.
And I understand that, you know, this is a state requirement, so we have to do something. But the other question is a little more, again, kind of a broader base, but how much housing could we get, or middle housing could we get, just by focusing on the, you know, the vacant lots in this defined area?
I think in the presentation we, in the presentation we did look at vacant lots that are within the area. And one of the things we were really looking at was how many of those are non-conforming to where you can't build on them currently. And I think there were like 1,600 lots or so that were vacant and were non-conforming. So currently you can't build anything on them. And by reducing the minimum lot size from 7,000 to 6,000 or something of that sort, it opens up all of those properties for potential redevelopment. So there were quite a few vacant lots that I think there is that potential for redevelopment.
Yeah, it would be interesting to me to see what, you know, what number of vacant lots.
And we can, and we have this, but we have some additional data, which we're happy to share with the commission as we move forward.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. Thank you.
Commissioner Walczak and then Commissioner Silva.
I have a follow-up to that question. When code amendments are made, are property owners notified blanketly? Do letters get sent to them saying, hey, your lot now is under these new regulations, it might be developable? Do you proactively do that? You just wait for people to come to you?
There is not a requirement to notice individual property owners when you make changes to the zoning code. If it's something like a zoning overlay, that would require that, as far as, because that's a change of the actual zone and a rezoning. But for a code change, it would not require us to do so.
Thank you, Nick, for the presentation. And I want to like go after Commissioner Willett. You guys have done an amazing job of like listening to everyone and crafting a code that like represents what all the public outreach does. And I think that's really impressive. Talking to the affordability, or how do we make this pencil out? Like, the reality is no one's building middle housing because you can't afford it right now. An average 600 square foot house in the city right now won't cost you less than $200,000, right? So if you want to build a quad, $800,000. People don't have that. So I think we do have to focus on reducing minimum lot sizes to density, because the only way to make this affordable and the only way to make this pencil out is that you could build one. It's easier to find someone that can invest $200,000 and build one, and then you get a group that can do them all, than get $800,000. And that's just being very minimum. On the topic of the minimum lot sizes to density, assuming this is the path we go forward with, I'm assuming that most of the lots that we're gonna, that are going to apply to be split, are either lots facing an alley or a corner lot. Once you split these lots, they get access from both sides. How do we not make it a requirement to make these lots sites? Because they shouldn't have to have shared things if they don't have the same access. I understand they should be a site if you're doing one with just a frontage, but how do we make them independent? Because I think one of the harder things right now when you're trying to do these type of things with a flexible lot development is you have to end up in like an HOA, a development package, all the things we're trying to stay away from. So how do we make it possible that, given the option that your lot has separate access, separate things, you do not have to conform to a site? I think that's one. And then I'm going to keep going a little bit of things.
Okay. Thanks.
Go. Sorry.
Thanks, Commissioner Silva. Just before I forget to answer that fully.
So you can establish a new site if you meet all the site requirements, like minimum lot size, access, pedestrian circulation through a site plan. So if you have all those things, you can establish a new site through zoning with showing that on a site plan. So if you maintain that same, the minimum lot size, you maintain your own access, you maintain your own pedestrian circulation, your own landscape, you would just have to show that on a site plan how it would operate alone.
Okay, great. At the beginning of the presentation, you talked that the Dragon Institute talks that one of the things that we need for more middle housing is lot coverage. Why have we not seen any changes in lot coverage in any of the zoning? And going back to that, there is a part that's weird to me in zoning where R2 has coverage for single family and multifamily, and it's the only R that has that. The next zonings, which are less restrictive, have a more restrictive lot coverage. So how do we translate that, or why haven't we addressed that?
Yeah, Commissioner Silva, actually that's something that I think as we started off in this process, we are looking at, there's requirements in the state bill for floor area ratio of 0.5. And we were looking at how we could come into conformance with that. And I think as the proposal has shifted a little bit, even though our lot coverages are pretty generous, and with the setbacks and everything else that are there, generally they don't really cause that much of a barrier. But as things have shifted a little bit, as we're reducing some of those minimum lot sizes, we may want to take a look at that.
I think if we're going for smaller minimum lot sizes, and that's something we're going to want to address, because then it's going to become the thing that's going to be the roadblock along the way. And then talking about dimensional standards, part of most of this area is in our central area, in our historic neighborhoods that were built before these code standards. A bunch of these neighborhoods, and what makes these neighborhoods special is the relation that they have to the street and to pedestrians, right? So a lot of these don't apply with the required 20-foot front yard setback. So I would like to, for us to propose some sort of exception where if any new infill development along a block face where the houses on that block face already have a less than 20-foot setback, new infill can build in any setback within that range. Because we want the new infill to look and feel like our historic neighborhoods. Like, that's something you can get through in an HPC, but we have like Barrio Santa Rita or Iron Horse, a bunch of these neighborhoods that don't have an HPC, and you couldn't get that front setback reduction. So that's something that I think we should consider, and I would like seeing. It wouldn't bring any house closer than any block face already, because that would be what limits you, but it would just build to our neighborhood character. And then I'm going to leave it for now and then come back a little bit later. Thank you.
Commissioner Lane.
Thank you. I have just a follow-up question to the lot splits. And separating, does this require separate utilities?
So Commissioner Lane, that's something we are looking at. As it is right now, and our current practice is for them to require separate utilities. But we've had some conversations about figuring out ways to do master metering and maybe have sub-metering within those. So it is something we are, one, taking feedback on, but also something that we are looking at. I will say that is outside of the zoning code changes that we're doing, because it's generally building code and building and policy related to building safety. But it is something that we know is a pretty significant barrier, and it was with ADUs, and that's why we did policy change for ADUs. So something we
are. It's really sewer and water that are the biggest two expenses, and so could there maybe not be like a cross property agreement, much like parking, if they're shared again sewer taps or something? And then I just had another clarifying. So if I'm understanding the subdivision option correctly, that means you could take a lot, put a fourplex on it and have four separate owners, but essentially, effectively, the lot stays as one lot and there could be shared utilities then? Or is that not what you're saying?
Thanks, Commissioner Lane. So the first part, correct. There could be those four units on it. They could be separate lots. But in that scenario, they would not be separate utilities. It would be different ownership.
Different ownership. So effectively, you're drawing lot lines. So it's not a like condominium. It's not a true condoization.
Correct.
And is there a conversation going on right now to allow for separate ownership on a single lot like condoization?
Commissioner Lane, yet you would still be able to condoize potentially a lot with four units as well. So you have that option. We've seen that because of condo liability laws and other things, that it's just really challenging to do so. And so some of the feedback we've received is that, you know, trying to find as many ways as possible to really both support, you know, more rentals and the rental model for multifamily, but also to support a homeownership model with this. That's kind of what we're trying to get at with.
Yeah. There's many folks in the city interested in trying to sell their ADUs, for example, and that's not possible. It doesn't seem right now. So, okay. And then these are like minutia kind of questions now. Would there be a process in place to allow for elevated balconies or outdoor spaces with alternative privacy mitigation rather than just saying no? Like if you wanted a larger window, you could do frosted glass. If you wanted to put louvers with the balcony or a wall that blocks view. So instead of just a blanket no, there's like proof of other privacy mitigation in place.
Yeah, Commissioner Lane. So we modeled this after what we've had in other regulations in the Unified Development Code. I think there may be room for either administrative process to allow for alternate like best practices or something of that sort.
Maybe a conversation with the neighbor to support the thing. I would advocate that there is an administrative process allowed for that kind of thing. I saw somewhere the a quick mention of parking in the front of the site. It says 400 square feet of vehicular use is including carports. And I just wondered, is there something in here that talks about reducing that 10-foot setback for carports in the front of these kinds of infill sites?
I don't believe it's in there, but it's something that we can look at. Respond.
And some, when we're increasing density, I think it's helpful to be able to build a carport up to a front lot line or closer than 10 feet if that's something you can consider. Okay, and then two more things. I'm going to just advocate very strongly for getting rid of the boundary and making this a blanket change to the zoning code right now. I understand the desire to create a stepping stone or a trial version of something in a smaller area, but it adds complexity to the review process. And I think that we are already basically drowning in administrative regulation, and review times are too long. And it just seems like a process, an additional process roadblock to an already complex piece of zoning change. So I still think that without the boundary, you can come back in a year or two and analyze progress without adding the additional cumbersome nature of this. And it sounds from what you've said that the public has also shared in your meetings that is something they'd be interested in. So again, I think this should be a blanket change to the zoning code with no boundary. And last, the trees or the landscape requirements, I would advocate to also include ADUs, please. One tree or ADU would be great. And then a couple of additional qualifying statements to the tree basin that you're requiring. It says that it needs to be at least 6 inches in depth. It would be great if it also included a statement that said all adjacent on-site hardscapes are sloped toward the basin rather than toward the street. I think that starts to imply what the long-range intention of a code change like this is getting us towards. And then additionally, I question why you're using the AD WR low water use plant list and not asking for trees that are on the Tucson Basin native plant list. Those would be better and more supportive of our ecosystem here. And again, I think meet long-range goals for why we're making changes like this to the code.
So just to respond related to ADWR and the reason why we're doing that is because that's what we already have required in the other parts of our code. So we're just being consistent with what we already require. So there isn't two separate lists that are out there. I will say there are, you know, potential opportunities in the future, maybe even with low impact development standards, to look at some of those and see whether or not there's more appropriate land lists and things of that sort.
All right. I think I'll go with Commissioner Wellett, Walczak, Silva, and that gets us in order.
Okay. I want to talk about the boundary. Why, how did we get there? I recognize that it's a directive from the council, but like, what can you fill us in? What was the sentiment? Why did we stop at Country Club? Like, why Country Club?
Thanks, Commissioner Wellett. Yeah, so a few reasons why we stopped at Country Club. One being the adopted Tucson Norte Sur Country Club area. We wanted to go with something that was already adopted by City of Tucson through a public process. Two, we've already spoken to a lot of members of that part of the community. We have not gotten a chance to do a lot of outreach outside of that area. And we thought it might be a little bit... We thought that we would get a better opportunity to do a little bit more outreach before we have sent him.
Two rounds of outreach, though, and majority of the comment is suggesting a citywide or larger area. But what we're running with the trial and error because historic neighborhoods have suggested that there is a fear that this will change. However, in your presentation this evening, you also suggested that this type of development in fact protects and preserves established and historic spaces. And large in part, this is the type of development that created the character in these historic barrios back in the day. And so I run into this challenge, and this isn't, you know, coming strong at you personally, but I run into the space of when we look at if it's already allowed in the city, it's why it's not happening, it's a challenge with development standards and cost. Why are we just going to stop at an arbitrary boundary because of, you know, not enough outreach? Maybe we skip the neighborhoods in this realm. But when I look at this stopping at Country Club, that's not even what most people account or associate Midtown Tucson with being. As I understand, Midtown is often Wilmont further out where there is a lot of neighborhood activity centers. There's large commercial centers, et cetera. So just stopping at Country Club seems like a really, you know, we're not thinking about the whole picture. And then further, what we're doing is suggesting that in wards 1, 6, 3, they get middle housing, but nothing in 2 and 4, not a lot in 5, because we don't go far enough south in spaces where we arguably need more of that diversity in housing to change some of this affordability that we see. And honestly, It often perpetuates this elitist, you know, the east side is for those who can afford it. And we've got to start changing that perspective. I also think we need to be looking at the areas where we are trying to incentivize housing. So on the south side, we should perhaps look at golf links because we're not including the Thrive and the 29, which we're investing in a whole lot of space right now to increase affordability, but we're not making that mechanism where it needs to be. And then we talk about Norte Sur and the whole process and the endeavor put forth there is this notion of how do we keep people where they exist today and provide the opportunity. And here, I don't see us doing that, where we're not creating an opportunity in other spaces. So I look at this boundary as an opportunity not only to protect the established neighborhoods and the character, to provide additional affordability, but also it serves at this you know, this notion of keeping people where they live, because we can create that multi-generational. So we're talking anti-displacement, we're talking anti-gentrification, et cetera. And these are all things that I feel we've got to allow for it. And just simply stopping at Country Club, we're not talking about Alvernon and Grant, an area that needs a lot of additional housing support, et cetera. So I full and well will support and will push for a larger boundary, you know, at least to, you know, a more centralized location within the city that represents all wards and not just those within, you know, the downtown space. Before I jump, I wanted to also talk about the landscape standards. Can you guys clarify for me, does this apply to only missing middle, or is it new single family residential and missing middle? Because it's kind of only talked about as new single family in the heading. Everything else is in suggestion to middle housing. So can you clarify?
Yeah, so Commissioner Well, it is for new single family housing and missing middle, or middle, not missing.
Can we discuss, and can you guys provide clarity on, you know, when, how is this enforced? Because right now, when we look at a subdivision and a lot, oftentimes individual lots, and not oftentimes, always, we talk about perimeter landscape borders that are required. Currently in subdivisions, landscaping is not required on lot. So what is the mechanism that we are going to, when, how do you show this landscaping to be provided on a lot? And then how does that, you know, work out for those builders building it, where landscaping in our, you know, on our yards are often left to the homeowner to choose? And how are we going to enforce that? So is it part of the development package? Is it a part of building plan permits? Like, where, what's the mechanism and the timing for this to come into place?
Yeah, so it would be on your plans when you submit your plans and your construction documents. You would have like the landscaping on there, and that would be approved when it comes through. And then we would inspect for that to make sure that it meets those, you know, what the plans say. And kind of that's how it's going. We were trying to strike a balance here because obviously you have to have the same standards for single family as you do for middle housing. And we wanted to make sure that there still are standards related to landscaping for middle housing. As we do this. And so we're striking a balance between something that's easy enough for a single family homeowner who's, you know, just doing a one-off house, but also something that still is impactful and really does kind of support kind of the contextual area and also, you know, meets our climate goals and things of that sort.
Right. No, I understand the landscape. It's just the mechanism of how do we get it? Because in a subdivision on a plat, you don't talk about landscaping on lots. So is it just simply a note that says one tree and five shrubs or whatever it is that will be provided on lot at the plat? And then when you go through the next step of your reviews and things like that, that's when you will indicate what that plan for the landscaping on lot is.
Yeah, Commissioner, well, so I think if I'm understanding the question correctly, it's when are you showing the landscape for the site? And what Dan was saying on the site plan. So right now, if it's just a middle housing lot, you would show the landscape on your building plan. And so it would just be a little bit extra than what we're requiring right now on a regular plot plan, but you would show where that tree location is going to be, where the ground cover is going to be, indicate as a note, probably how this is going to be watered. And so it is expanding the building plans a little bit when you submit them, but it is showing that on that building plan. So we're not requiring any sort of development package, or we don't want to have a landscape architect create the plans either. So it's a simplified version of a landscape plan on a building plan.
Okay, awesome. No, that's helpful for sure, because I didn't grab that there. When we talk about in the code, we suggest, you know, low or very water use based on the AWRD list. The AWRD doesn't distinguish between very low and low. It just has plants, right, that suggest low water use. And so when we talk about very low or low plants at a hardiness rating of 15% or 15 degrees, to who? Who's making that call? Who's saying this? Is it a matter of if the landscape architect at the city agrees with one thing and we've got a you know, plant supplier suggesting something different? How does that, to who? Who's making the interpretation there? Because I think it's not as clear here.
Thanks, Commissioner. The ADWR plant list from the fourth active management plan includes a lot of that detail. The fifth management plan does not, but it includes more species. We are also going to be providing ample information and resources on our website, as we do with other parts of our code, to help people find that information and make the best decision for themselves.
Okay. Would there be a way to add language that, you know, if it's not one of this list or whatever the list we are suggesting, that there is the opportunity for the developer, the homeowner, to work with the city to say, I've done my research, here's the plant, do you agree? So there's that more flexible process written into this, as opposed to, I know it would happen on the outside of it, but, you know, we need that certainty in code that there is that process there for that flexibility. You don't have to answer me on that if you don't want. That was an open-ended question there. But on, I don't know what page it is, but on one of the pages, we talk about vegetative ground cover. How do we define that? Because ground cover on the AWR D list is plants. Are we just talking about vegetative coverage there? And then can you guys clarify why what's the rationale behind why trees need to be 10 feet from enclosed buildings?
As for how ground cover is defined, we can look into that more and be more clear. Thank you for indicating that. And then distance from enclosed buildings, I believe that comes from other parts of our code. It's to make sure that the water that's collected in the basin doesn't disturb the foundation of the building. It also is to protect the tree, make sure it's unobstructed, and make sure it can get access to water in order to survive.
And then the last question I'm going to bring up as it relates to landscape requirements, and I think this is just a general one, no one has to answer it, but how are we going to enforce it? Because currently we have, you know, enforcement issues as it exists on commercial properties. Now we bring in the private property, you know, after the fact. How are we going to ensure as we move forward? And I know there's some language in here that suggests that it should be done, but how do we ensure that this will be the case so that we can continue to meet the city's, you know, climate goals, et cetera?
Yeah, I think enforcement is a challenge when you start to add requirements like this to single family homes. I will say that it is a zoning requirement, and you can, you know, through a code enforcement case, you can address those type of things if it's not meeting the code.
Thank you.
Commissioner Walza.
Thank you. I'm just going to be the third commissioner to lobby for expanding this citywide. Lexi said mostly everything I wanted to cover, with the exception of I was really convinced to support the CCT, the Community Corridors tool, when it was up for our review, because of the picture you all painted of creating walkable neighborhood nodes in different parts of our city that are more car oriented. And I feel like, yeah, having this boundary end at Country Club kind of is like, we're inching towards that vision and now we're pulling back. I'd like to keep inching towards that vision and not pull back. That's all I'm going to add to that.
Commissioner Silva.
I want to touch base on the plant list. I know it's in other parts of the code, and I understand it's a big endeavor to change the whole code, but I went through the whole plant list, and we have at least 27 non-native species and at least 7 invasive species in that plant list. If we enforced every single family house and every residential lot to put these plants in, there is no going back. We have issues with buffalo grass, and now we have to release sheep on a mountain to be able to eat it. So, like, if we can't change the whole code, that's sad to hear. I wish we could. If we can change the residential code, we should. Like, we shouldn't just conform to this list, and I would not feel comfortable, like, people planting a eucalyptus, because that's what they're going to plant. They're not going to choose what they have. So the Tucson Bird Alliance list is more local to Tucson. It has plants from the Tucson Basin. I think we have, like, if we are building a city based on where we are, we're surrounded by national parks, we have to, like, embrace that. We don't have to bring trees from Australia, from wherever. So, like, I am going to push to, like, take that plant list out. A weird part of the text in the code in 763, residential development with four or fewer units per site is exempt from section 764. Section 764, use of drought tolerant vegetation. So I think there's something weird how that is written, or yeah.
Yeah, Commissioner Silva, I believe that was an incorrect. We need to clarify that and fix that. That was something we saw in the.
Okay. Yeah. And then I understand the 10-foot setback from an enclosed building. There is a 6-foot setback with the sidewalk that seems a bit arbitrary for me. Like, why is it a 6-foot setback from the sidewalk? Could it be 5? Could it be 4? Like, could we have something where, like, that front setback is something that you can, like, play with more? Because at the time, if you have to plant a tree that's 6 feet from the sidewalk and 10 feet from the house, and then the house can only be, talking about the old neighborhoods, at 16 feet from the street, so you couldn't have closer houses, which is something that all our historic barrios are doing. So how do we provide some flexibility there? And then I'm going to touch on what Commissioner Lane said. I would not want to see cars closer to the sidewalk. I would, like, if it were up to me, I would see no cars whatsoever. I would force cars to park in the back of properties. So I do not think we should ease restrictions for carports to be closer to the sidewalk. At some point, you talk about at least a 5-foot buffer for landscape. That's, like, at least the minimum that we have to leave. But you don't want to be walking in a city and abutting the back of cars all the time. You want to be interacting with houses and landscape and people. And a question on parking, now that we're in parking. When you talk about the parking, you state that if you're within a quarter mile from a transit or an in-house enhanced route by the bicycle plan, yet the bicycle master plan doesn't define the routes as enhanced routes. It has them defined as either an existing in progress or future bike boulevard or an existing and in progress shared use path. So.
Do you want to? Commissioner Silva, that's something that we've been in discussions with Department of Transportation Mobility on ways to clarify that. It's really probably going to be what we're looking at is multi-use paths, bike boulevards, and I can't remember the last one, but the basically utilizing their terms for that to make sure that that's clear.
I guess what I'm going at is, like, I want to make sure we include all the in progress and future, not just the existing ones, because it's a work in progress. So, like, that's where I was going to get to that one, like, include all of the master plan. Thank you.
Commissioner Kinney.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Good job. And thank you all for all your work on this. This is a big one. Seems like we have a lot of big ones lately. So I have a couple of comments. Everyone has touched on a lot of them already. One of them, though, was loosening restrictions on subdivision requirements. I don't know if you all looked into maybe making subdivision approvals for 5 lots or less, not requiring mayor and council approval, maybe making them either administrative or maybe a zoning examiner if we have to. It's a high bar because, like, there's this spot between 3 lots and 5. And I think a lot of this middle housing lives in there. But, you know, to do that, you have to go through this platting process. And it's very cumbersome and it takes forever. And just the mayor and council portion of it adds a couple of months usually to the process because you have to get on the agenda, which takes forever. And almost all the time, they just approve it anyway. So,
Commissioner Kinney, there's actually was a state bill that was passed, I don't know, back in the last legislative session that requires us to actually do those administratively. And so we are working on an administrative process for our plats. So it would no longer go through mayor and council for approval. So we actually are working on that for all plats.
Okay, Great. Wow.
Citywide.
I'll be out of a job. Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about was the whole citywide versus defined and then historic, which in my mind kind of overlap. So I was in favor of going citywide, and then thinking about this, you know, once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back. If we go citywide, we can't pull it back. It's going to be a huge regulatory taking of people's property rights. I don't think the city wants to get in that position. If they're willing to take that risk, then maybe we could do that. But I think that, in my mind, is the biggest consideration for doing this citywide. A potential solution, I don't know if you all looked into this, was that in the bill, it says that obviously these won't apply where there are already private restrictions that say you can't do this. And so I think those become probably more common as you go east. I don't know. It totally depends on the subdivision. But also in the bill, it says that these requirements don't have to apply in the vicinity of military airports and international airports. And that's a defined term. And that vicinity covers a lot of Tucson. I looked at the map and it covers like half the city. I see that we're going above and beyond and we're choosing not to exempt those areas from this middle housing. But I think certain HPZs and NPZs and other areas could use that to opt out of this. It doesn't cover all the HPZs, unfortunately, and it doesn't cover all the NPZs, unfortunately, but looking at the map, it looks like Armory Park could be exempted, some of Barrio Historico, Rincon Heights, some of Una, you know. So I don't know. I think there's ways to exempt certain areas if we need to. So keep that in mind. Real quick, again, on historic stuff, I agree that in a lot of the HPZs, you can already do a lot of middle housing. Not so much maybe the fourplexes and up, but the duplexes and triplexes, yes. And I'm happy to hear that the design standards in those areas will still apply and be enforced. That's good to hear. I wasn't sure, honestly, looking at the bill. It, you know, I think that's a matter of interpretation, and I'm glad the city's taking a narrow interpretation of that. So that's good. That's all I got. Thank you.
Commissioner Lane.
Sorry, I just have one last comment to beat, or, you know, into the conversation about the trees. The diameter of the basin is something that I'm a little concerned that it's not mentioned at all. I fear that if you don't set some kind of dimensional standard for it, we'll get like 12-inch little divots around trees. So I think standard practice would be a diameter that matches the anticipated adult-sized tree diameter for the top. And you already have a requirement that basins need to be 2 feet from the property line. So perhaps that helps with the setback from the sidewalk. I don't think there needs to be a very big setback from a sidewalk. I don't understand the logic of that. And then again, I think that the sloping all the hardscapes toward these basins starts to push us, inch us toward a place where this like gray water and rainwater harvesting actually starts to work on these sites. So, and then I'm just going to mention like our historic neighborhoods. I mean, as a designer, we're trained to design within the context of these areas to begin with. And this type of architecture, multi-family, multi-unit housing, is more common in the historic neighborhoods than others. So I don't know that, I mean, and given the financial barriers right now, it just I don't think the blanket change to the zoning code versus setting your boundary is going to make a big difference to those neighborhoods. But it does create more work for you guys, and I'm against that at every stop. It's taking too long already, so make it easier, please. okay, done.
Commissioner Silva.
Final thing. I support City Wet as well. Also understand the hardships of it. Worth considering in the process of it. If it's not possible or whatever to go citywide, do we have an opt-in process where anyone through the city can develop there and then within the year we roll out citywide? But then, like, is that an option that we can do? Worth considering.
I like that idea. Commissioner Small.
Along those lines, I can see both sides of the argument for the boundary. However, I'm going back to your comment that what was it, 1,600 vacant lots, and I think one of the things we're working on here is the effort to sort of densify this city, and if we've got 1,600 in this one area. I think the encouragement should be to try to, well, not enforce, but encourage, you know, the vacant lots that are in this inner zone to be developed. I mean, I've lived a variety of places, and I've never seen so many vacant properties near to the central business district as I have in my hometown. I've seen vacant lots. Well, clearly, if they're vacant lots, they've been vacant for a long time, that I used to ride my bike past as a child, and they're still not developed 50 some years later. And my encouragement would be to try to encourage development in these lots that are 1 mile, 1.5 miles, 2 miles from the central business district.
May I just add to that I would be in favor of not necessarily going citywide, but having an emphasis on developing the vacant lots for middle housing in some fashion.
I think the reality is 1,600 empty lots times 4 is 6,400 housing units. That is way below what we need. Right? What's the housing unit number that we have? So I think like the idea of empty lots is like nice and cute, but like it's not a reality. Like the reality is all the backyards are empty. Like we have to densify the city if we want to get to our housing goals. Like,
but it's not just the vacant lots we're talking about. We're talking about the vacant.
So we've been discussing over past hour all these options, and I think it's been a great and robust discussion. Loved it. One of the things that I've got to be thinking is, as we've done ADUs, we've done the CCT, we're now talking about middle housing, but what are we doing to really inform the majority of citizens about all these options that are available to them? Like, is there something at PDSD that says, hey, if you want to develop your lot, come talk to us. You have options. Like, I'm willing to bet Del Arcedona's, the majority of people don't know what's available to them.
They don't.
Yeah. So, yeah, Commissioner Ortiz Pino, this is something that, you know, one, I will say, the Pro Housing Grant, that's really a big portion of this is really that education, that technical assistance, that outreach that goes along with it. Also, you know, that idea of the model plan library and really kind of building that capacity of the community in order to really build the housing we need. And so that's a big portion of it. And we plan to utilize it for that. There's even, you know, we even have a lead planner that's going to be hired from that. We'll have staff that's actually funded by this grant. So that's one way to do so. I will say, like, related to the community corridors tool, We have been working on doing that as well, to try to get the word out, try to educate people as much as possible. We've created educational materials. We've done gone out and spoken to different you know, professional groups, et cetera. So it's challenging to get the word out to everyone, but that is something that we even have, you know, money for and funding for related to that.
Love that for you guys.
Commissioner Wellett.
Well, if there's no other discussion, then I will go ahead and make a motion to set the middle housing for public hearing on October 15th.
Okay. Do I have we have a second? So no call for a second study session on this guy?
Don't say that. You keep that to yourself over there.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Let's, can I get a, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those in favor say not in favor say nay. Hearing none, we have a public hearing for October 15th on hearing for the Middle Housing Code Amendment. Great work, guys. Great discussion. It's been fascinating. Call for item number 4. Data centers code amendment.
Oh, one more thing before we get into this. Parking, I believe, closes at 8 o'clock on the parking garage. So if there's anybody who needs to move their car or anything of that sort. Okay. Just wanted to make sure everyone was aware.
Does anybody need a quick recess for parking? Going once, twice. Let's continue.
All right. Thank you, Chair Ortiz-Pino and Commission. We are here this evening to talk about a recent request by Mayor and Council to develop a UDC code amendment for large-scale data centers within the city of Tucson. A little bit of background on this is that we are seeing nationally and actually globally that there's a proliferation of large-scale data centers being developed. This is driven in many cases by increased use of AI, cloud computing, many, many more devices that are currently wired, and just generally a evolution or change in how we conduct our lives digitally. There was a recent proposal for a data center that would have been brought into the city of Tucson, known as Project Blue. I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. Mayor and Council decided not to move forward with consideration of the annexation and development agreement for Project Blue at their August 6th meeting. At that time, as part of the motion, Mayor and Council requested that staff work with the Planning Commission to develop a UDC amendment to establish standards for regulation of large-scale data centers. Mayor and Council at that time also requested that a large quantity water users ordinance be developed. And so that leads us to the present considerations of where we are with regard to data center regulation under the UDC. So the UDC currently addresses data storage as a storage use, and that is an older provision in the UDC that is really looking at smaller scale types of, you know, server rooms or, you know, not the hyperscale data centers. They're just what we would have previously have considered sort of data storage use. So large-scale data centers are not covered by the UDC as a result. There was a recent determination by the zoning administrator that data centers would currently be classified as a generating system land use. And this determination letter is included in your packet and is posted online. It's worth noting that a generating system land use is not permitted by right anywhere in the city and is only permitted by PAD. So currently, if a data center were to propose to go into the city, it would be required to go through the PAD approval process. So that's just sort of how we've interpreted the UDC currently.
It's also worth noting a little bit of information on the large quantity water user ordinance. This was actually adopted by mayor and council on August the 19th. This large quantity water user ordinance does not prohibit large quantity water users. Instead, it establishes a threshold of approximately 7.4 million gallons per month. If you exceed that consumption of water, then you would be required to meet the provisions of this ordinance. At a sort of high level, that includes development of detailed water conservation plans, implementation of techniques to reduce use, improve water use efficiency, increase use of reclaimed water, and also demonstrate that there would be a significant economic benefit to the community through this large water use that's being proposed. This is required within the entire Tucson Water Service area for all new connections. So it's just worth noting that that is not related to any UDC code amendment, but it is part of how data centers would be regulated. So when Mayor and Council requested that we develop this UDC amendment, they gave some fairly specific direction in the form of the motion. Number one was that that we include a definition for data center or large-scale data center. So we really want to be clear about what this is that we are talking about or what we're not talking about. There is also included a request that that data centers be permitted by mayor and council special exception, which also requires a zoning examiner review prior to going to mayor and council special exception. And so in many ways, that process is something that is similar to a rezoning, except you're not actually rezoning the process, but you're going through sort of the similar steps of neighborhood meeting, notification, zoning examiner review, and then mayor and council consideration on public hearing. So it's just something to think about that, or keep in mind that that's something that they are specifically requesting. Mayor and council also laid out that they wanted us to look at other examples from other jurisdictions where they have adopted data center requirements as a result of this proliferation in this particular land use. And so what we did was that we started to look at data center regulations in other jurisdictions, to get a better idea of what was done in those areas. Specifically, we looked at the jurisdictions within the state of Arizona that have adopted data center regulations, which are the city of Chandler, the town of Marana, the city of Phoenix, and the city of Mesa. And so we looked at specifics on each of these and kind of compared across certain parameters, including how they define data centers, where they're permitted, how they address noise, site building requirements, utilities, parking, those sorts of things. And so we found that in many ways they were very similar, but there are also some key differences and some key takeaways in how they address them, which I'll get into a little bit more detail here. One of the things that we saw with the city of Chandler was that they do have a more robust neighborhood notification and meeting requirement than a lot of the other jurisdictions. They're requiring that there be notice and that there be a neighborhood meeting specific to the data center proposal. So this would be beyond, I'm presuming, their regular sort of entitlements process. And so that's something that they felt was important for their community. Town of Marana, they permit data centers as a principal use via a specific plan, which to my understanding is sort of similar to our either PAD or special exception. So it's an entitlements process that would be required to go through. One interesting provision here, all the jurisdictions require that you demonstrate availability of adequate water and electrical service for these, you know, very resource consumptive uses. But in the case of the town of Marana, they specifically state that potable water may not be used for cooling in a data center. City of Phoenix has similar requirements, only permitted only in select zones with a special permit. So again, that's that sort of public process, entitlements process. They're focused a lot on noise mitigation for their data centers. There's even a little bit of provision for aesthetics in there that was different than some of the other jurisdictions. And then we have the city of Mesa. Again, fairly similar. It's principal use via, it's permitted via pad overlay. Accessory uses for a data center permitted under some other conditions. In terms of Mesa, one of the interesting things with it was that their definition for a data center was a bit broader than what we saw in other jurisdictions. They talked about specific types of operations, whether it's AI, blockchain, cryptocurrency, those sorts of things. They were the only jurisdiction that we saw that actually kind of went down to that level in terms of their interpretation. And so, Just to recap here what we saw when we looked at these other jurisdictions, and I'm being very high level here, we can drill down if there are any specific questions, but there is some sort of entitlements approval process for all of the jurisdictions. Everyone requires that you demonstrate adequate utilities in terms of particularly power and water. Marana prohibits use of potable water. Chandler has the most robust engagement process. Mesa has the broadest definition. And Phoenix is concerned in many instances with noise mitigation. So once we looked at what other jurisdictions have done in this case, we started to look at how we really wanted to engage in terms of developing the provisions for the UDC amendment. I do want to just take a moment here to note that this is essentially a preliminary study session. We don't have anything developed at this point in time. The purpose here is really to brief you as a commission and get your feedback. And then once we receive your feedback, we'll begin working on the actual code language and engagement. And so what we're proposing is a process where we form what we're calling a technical advisory committee to come together for a couple of meetings, comprise this committee of experts in any areas that relate to data centers, whether it be water, electricity, the data center construction industry, people who are concerned about environmental impacts of data centers, and any other stakeholders. We'd like to bring them together as this sort of advisory committee to look at ways to develop regulations that could, you know, satisfy their areas of concern as it relates to the specific land use. The idea there is to then come up with a proposal, develop a proposed red line ordinance, or, you know, maybe not fully fleshed out, but something to then bring to the public through a series of community meetings, both virtual and in person. And during those community meetings, we could speak to the proposal and then get that broader public feedback, integrate that information into the actual proposal, and then bring it back to you as a more fleshed out code amendment for another more formal study session at that point in time to get your feedback. And then from there, we would, you know, look at the things that we've talked about already in terms of, like, including a definition, mayor and council special exception, looking at what specific zoning districts we'd like to permit the use in, and then also look at specific use, you know, look at potential use specific standards. How do we want to look at noise mitigation, landscaping, stormwater management, parking, any of the other issues that may go into these types of uses? And so that would come from you, it would come from the technical advisory committee, it would come from members of the public, and we could integrate those into the proposed red line ordinance. And so what we're looking at in terms of a tentative timeline here is obviously bring this to you for the initial study session this evening, receive feedback from you, and then begin the process of standing up and engaging the technical advisory committee, the community meetings, developing the red line ordinance, hopefully by the end of December of this year, and then coming back tentatively in January, assuming that the engagement process happens within that period of time, coming back tentatively in January, setting potentially for public hearing in February, and then bringing to Mayor and Council for consideration in March. So what we're asking for this evening is if you can take some time to provide us with feedback on what you would like to see or your thoughts on the proposed, on any UDC code amendment for data centers, so that we can integrate that into the work that we're going to do.
I'm going to give our online commissioner first go. Abriza?
Thank you for the presentation, and thank you for the middle housing presentation. I have not been here for a while. So I was looking into this project, and I actually found the Library of Congress produced a document on 8/26 of this year, S. 1475, and it speaks directly about data centers and has a lot of information on where they're located, how much energy they produce, how much water they use, that I think may be beneficial when in the space they take up when we're looking at the UDC code. I personally think it's a bad idea to put a high water use, high energy facility data center in the middle of the desert that produces tons of heat. It just seems to me in general principle is a bad idea. I think it would work in the desert if it was buried to prevent the heat load. Also, when I was reading through this, I think a big consideration of future water use that we're going to need, and we all know that we are in a severe drought and we have a lack of water, and that maybe like Marana, where it states that no potable water can be used in a facility in Tucson, it may also be that pumping excessive water out of our watershed that we've been protecting over the years and contributing to with our CAP allocations is a giveaway. Also, on another, you said that I guess the City of Water has put this large-scale water user, a definition of as far as large-scale water user. Now, if I imagine that comes through the City of Tucson Water, excuse me. So how much are they paying as far as how does it equate to residential rates? It should be higher than residential rates. They should not be given a break for using our precious water. They do not provide that many jobs, maybe in the construction phase, but as these data centers run, basically, they store services, cloud services, they compute statistics on what we're browsing on to sell to other people to apply to us to buy more. So they do provide a service, not particularly a service to me individually, but to a service to people who want to sell stuff to me. So anyway, that's just my point, but I want to see more information on this large scale water user, more information about that and how that applies to data centers versus residential users and other commercial users. Thank you.
Commissioner McKenzie.
Thank you. First, just a point of clarification, these data centers don't have to use those tremendous quantities of water for cooling. In fact, I think I just read today that Project Blue is converting to an air-cooled system, so that reduces the amount of the water use. But I want to get more into the just some of these things in your presentation, one of which is the definition of a data center. And I think the trying to define it based on the functions that the data center is doing, like AI or social media, is incorrect. You should base it on the equipment, that's in there, like the servers, number of servers, size of servers, size of the modules that they're putting in, and that type of thing. The other thing is, in terms of the regulatory areas that were listed for some of the other benchmarks that you did to the other cities, there's a number of additional ones you should probably have. One is the backup generator. It's going to be a point source for emissions, whether it's diesel, if it happens to be diesel and gas, which a lot of them probably will have because they'll want a primary and a backup fuel source. That'll be an emissions point source. Solid waste disposition. There are going to be batteries in that place, lithium batteries, discarded chips, when that stuff gets used up. And then there's the fiber optics, data transmission in and out, cell towers or whatever these things are connected to. Enhanced fire suppression because of some of the batteries and some of the other heat removal things that may screw up and not work. Major security systems they'll have. And then in terms of the analog for these things, like a power generating facility, I thought really hard about that since that was most of my 40-year career. And it fits in some ways, doesn't fit in others. But it's really more like a huge, commercial building with a big old, HVAC system on top of it. So there are a lot of industrial size pieces of equipment, cooling towers and motors, fans, pumps, heat exchangers, chillers, all this kind of stuff. So it is heavy industrial, but it's scaled up versions of what are on top of commercial buildings already, right? So I think we should think a little harder on some of the definitions and the regulatory areas that we'll want to look at this thing. So I'll just stop there.
So I see some hands up. I just got to say something here. So to the point of the zoning determination on the generation use, that's been determined, and the only way to appeal that determination is to actually go to the Board of Adjustments and appeal the administrator's decision. I wouldn't agree with it either, but this wouldn't be the place to discuss what that use has been determined to be, to say it that way.
Thank you, Chair Ortiz-Pino. And just to clarify, that is meant to be an interim determination until this code amendment is adopted that is going through a public process for this type of input on how to define that use, et cetera. We realize it's an imperfect use. That's often what determinations are doing. We're trying to determine how to best classify a land use for something that there is no defined land use for, because this is such a new use that we had not contemplated in recent updates to the code. So, that's correct in terms of the process. And so the net that was a interim determination, and the next step is to create this code amendment to fully define that use.
So, quick question to that point then is, if this body were to disagree fundamentally with that determination, would we have to then somehow request the Board of Adjusters to review that determination? Or like, would we decide kind of moving forward with that, how we would classify the use?
I'm not sure about the Planning Commission's ability to appeal. That's a great question, Chair Ortiz-Pino, and that's something we could consult with the City Attorney's Office on. We have had boards and commissions appeal decisions in the past, not a determination that I'm aware of, but that's something we can get clarity on and sort of in terms of what that steps are, what those steps would be. I think what we're looking for, though, is more input on
how should it be defined as a use so that we can build that into this code amendment that will define the use, develop the standards for that use, where it should go, how it should be regulated, et cetera.
Yeah. So to that point, to add to this discussion, when I think of a generation facility, I work at one. It is an old coal burning facility with smokestacks. It emits emissions. It's been converted to natural gas, but it emits emissions. That's one of the reasons why it's a generation facility and it's a PAD entitlement. There are reasons why we would want that separate, clear and apart. One of the things that I hear Commissioner McKenzie bringing up was a data center is essentially just a large warehouse in a commercial. It's just a big box with servers inside. It does not have emissions other than, you know, some heat from HVAC and heat pumps and that sort of thing. So the use continuous, yeah. And so there's, I think, a total misclassification as to what it is and how we would then determine that. And like, I'm not saying that, you know, they need to be permitted in commercial areas, but I think classifying it as a generation use, we can keep it as a PAD. That doesn't really matter to me, but it is wholly distinct from a generation facility, in my opinion. Commissioner Wolczak.
Can I just ask about that? Okay, I had way too close of an upfront seat to Project Blue over these last 6 months, given who I work for. And I think part of the problem with what you just said is that folks have never seen anything use as much water and electricity as these things. And the offsets of required for that much energy and water are, you don't see them at the facility, but they impact the community. So I'm not defending the zoning administrator's decision, but I do think that that's something to take into consideration as we sort of grapple with how to define these things because of how much they consume and how much that's not dealt with on the site.
We just need to understand where that power comes from, and it's not being generated at that location.
Right.
And I think to all of this is there's such a lack of education. Like, I mean, we've got a couple, you know, subject matter experts here, people that know. I personally don't have enough to know about. I don't know all the ins and outs, you know, and I think that's true largely for the public as well. And so it's, you know, and I'm not one to want to do more of these meetings because we do enough of them in my life personally. But I before a draft, language, you know, any draft was presented, I personally would like a presentation from subject matter experts as it relates to how these things are used, because I mean, new information comes out, it seems, every day on these uses. You know, it's, oh, water cools it. Well, no, it's not. Water is not the only mechanism to cool these things. And so I think it's, what are all, you know, how do we be the most educated in our information? And I think if we're establishing a TAC, maybe the TAC comes and gives a presentation to the commission before a draft is presented to us. And I think perhaps maybe that should happen with the public as well. It's not just, oh, we're going to present code, and, you know, we're going to work behind this, you know, closed door, you know, give something for them to chew on. No, I think it needs to start at square one, and it needs to start with the basics of education. And it's not only to this body here, it's not to the council that's going to make the decision on this, but it's the public at a whole, because I think there is so much misconception about the use, what it is and what it is not. You know, and I'm not agreeing on one side of the table or what have you, but I think there is a lack of understanding as to what this is, what it could be, how it takes shape, how, you know, what the true benefit, what the cost, et cetera. And I think that's something, as a body that is going to be informing this, I certainly would appreciate that.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, if it's one thing we've learned about Project Blue data centers in the past month or so, is that this is something that matters deeply to this community. And the more public we can make that education, the better we're going to make this code.
And leave the technicalities up to those subject matter experts that mm-hmm. know what this is, and not, you know, a fear base or, you know, what have you. It needs to be a subject matter discussion for sure.
Yeah. Commissioner Walton.
That said, I did come prepared with a bunch of recommendations for you because I have learned a lot about this. So you did ask for those. Is this the appropriate time to give them to you? Okay. Commissioner McKenzie brought up a lot of really good points, but I'm curious what Commissioner McKenzie's opinions are of the MESA code. Now, from what I understand, MESA at first zoned these things as just commercial warehouses, which I'm hearing some of us talk about, and then freaked out when 15 of these popped up and they were like, whoa, this is not actually a commercial warehouse. This needs to be regulated much more stringently. And so you posted in your memo their very broad definition, which includes advanced operations, AI, blockchain, crypto, et cetera. I think, and I remember hearing in the mayor and council discussion about this, my council member who appointed me and Commissioner Silva said, look to MESA because they learned some hard lessons and they may have one of the more model requirements to look at these days. I don't know how everybody else feels about that, but that's where I would encourage Tucson to start. I also learned in all of this that there's over 140 data centers in the Phoenix Metro Valley area. That's astonishing, but also they do have a lot more surface water available in the Phoenix area than we do. And so I do think we need to look at Marana's code of not allowing any potable water use at all for data center use. One area that you all were not directed to look at, but I have been really interested in looking at, is Las Vegas. They're allotted even way less water than we are from the cap. And a couple years ago, I think they prohibited any new evaporative cooling, period. I don't know what that would look like here. Obviously, we have some large evaporative cooling systems. I think the U of A is one, TEP. Used to be. I don't know. Maybe they're not anymore. I don't know what that would look like, but I would encourage folks to dig into that, grandfather in, and of course exempt all of the little residential evaporative coolings. I have one. I love it. But maybe we don't want to let large scale industrial uses use them in Tucson. What else did I put in here? Let's see. I also want to just suggest that we consider prohibiting large scale data centers, point, like, period, in Tucson. I've learned that data centers come in all different sizes. We have a little one on First Avenue that a colleague walks past on his way to the bus stop. They can be small. Maybe they're more appropriately sized. There's some debate happening right now at the Board of Supervisors about whether or not you geographically need to be located near a data center in order to be able to use it for supporting your computing. I don't know anything about that, but I do think that we want to maybe look at, it's more appropriate to have small scale cottage style data centers and allow, regulate those so that Banner and El Rio and other places that need them can build them on site. We may not need them large scale in Tucson. I also have a question about neighborhood notifications. So I am thinking, like, where would a large scale one go in the current city boundaries? Or if we annexed in the future, who knows if that's going to happen. But I'm thinking down in the Southeast Corridor, right? What is the requirement for neighborhood notifications? Because neighborhoods are located very far from these sites.
So neighborhood notification, if it were to be like, have to be done through, I guess, the mayor and council special exception, like they were saying, it's all property owners within 400 feet, all neighborhood associations within a mile. That's our standard notification that we have for that.
Okay, so 400 feet. There may not be any neighborhoods within 400 feet of these in a lot of those places. And then neighborhood associations within a mile, same thing. We might not find a lot of neighborhood associations down in the southeast part. So that doesn't really give me any protections or sense of protection there. And then I have a couple more. You could say that you require mayor and council a special exception process for any large scales if you are going to just like point blank prohibit them. Categorical ban on potable water. Then there's like, you know, renewable energy. So TEP has their stated goals of pushing towards renewable energy goals by 2050. Is that right? And I think the community was really concerned that bringing online another natural gas powered electric generation plant for Project Blue was going to push TEP further away from that goal. I don't know. We looked into this in our work. It's really hard to require renewable sources of power for data centers because they use so much, but currently there's no requirement. So maybe there could be some requirements built in to offset electric use. I think that's all I've got. I have a note here too, written up referencing Plan Tucson guides, and should I send those to you? For you to just incorporate? Okay. All right.
Commissioner Lane?
I feel silly after something earlier today saying I'm not a data center expert, but I have some opinions. But I do understand large scale inputs and outputs and systems and the environment. And so I just have some thoughts. I'm also very familiar with being on a couple of different planning commissions and have learned that the public is really opinionated about this. and so I think we need to be mindful of that and careful and incredibly transparent about the process that we're about to go through. And so I have just a couple of questions that maybe you don't have answers to yet. One is that, so we're specifically talking right now about the UDC and land use only. And I'm sure that then the next step after this is the building regulations, which is maybe out of Tucson's control, but I'd be curious to understand how the building, I don't know, is it the IBC? Is it the IECC? Is there a building code that's like specific to these things? It would be a good idea maybe to become really familiar with that and how the UDC changes will interact with that secondary process. There's a concern that I like at the one of the things that they said early on was how many jobs this was going to bring to Tucson. And then as time has gone on, like drivels of information have come out. And so from what I understand, it provides a big push, like for a large scale data center, at least it would be a big giant push for construction jobs for a short term. And then there would be a smaller, much smaller amount of like permanent jobs for a while. So I would love to see something like this big Tucson or this big push for construction jobs would be Tucson based construction and trade companies, if we could put some kind of requirement on that. I don't know for sure. You were just talking about renewable resources, but it seems that these buildings, if they're using a lot of resource, the industry kind of came out and said, well, if we're using this much water, the output could also be that we're like cleaning the water and providing more, better water at the end of this, right? So is there a maybe net zero thinking approach to this? Like, can they actually, do they have the capability of producing energy while they're eating it up or something? And again, maybe that just means they need to subsidize other power sources in other parts of our city or something like that. Another question, are there actual heat emissions that physically come off of these buildings? And is there some sort of additional mitigation? Should we have a big giant solar shade device over the top of all of them? The actual physical emissions that you were talking about, batteries, chips, and no, okay.
Equipment
outputs, things that would basically go to landfills, I would imagine. Is there technology out there for how we could deal with that kind of thing? So I think that where I'm kind of headed is during the technical advisory committee step, I think it would be important to include disciplines related to like tech innovations and pushing on these companies to innovate further toward being able to handle whatever outputs the buildings themselves have. And last, just thinking about water, I mean, we can say no, you can't use our potable water sources, but then there's like energy. This is a resource conversation that I think goes beyond Tucson. And I commend you all very much for looking at the other municipal codes, but I would love to see an actual, like, can we spearhead a regional conversation about this? What happens in Marana affects us. What happens here affects them. What's happening on, you know, just east of us 100 miles affects us. Like, I think this entire thing could use a larger conversation for the Southwest region. And, you know, maybe we should try and see if we can start that.
And if I could just piggyback, ensuring that the tribal communities are a part of the dialogue, because that was something that was not as maybe it talked about as it should have. So I think that should be some stakeholders at the table for sure.
Yes, please.
So one question I have actually is about the makeup of the technical advisory committee. Who's deciding that? Who are the technical specialists? And can we ensure that we're part of their conversation?
Yeah, so Commissioner Ortiz-Pino, Carver will kind of share some of the people that we're kind of thinking about. Like right now, we're just trying to make sure that we're trying to look, one, get suggestions from you and from the community, but also trying to make sure that it is a balanced group that does bring those technical backgrounds that we really are looking for. So as you say, you know, having the subject matter experts that are there, that's what we're working on doing to make sure that they are at the table for that. And
can I just like reiterate though that you said specifically disciplines related to data centers, and I think that we need advocates for our environmental resources, and again, like tech innovation is a big I mean that's a probably very broad term, but really people who can drive the conversation and ask for more. Yeah,
to that point, like it shouldn't just be a one-sided advisory council. We need to have all parts of the perspectives on there.
Well, and Chair Ortiz-Pino and Commissioner Lane, yeah, I think exactly. And I think it's, you know, representatives from the water community, representatives from the energy community, et cetera. So all of the aspects that are related to this and just making sure that the right people are in the room for that.
Exactly. And that's what we're looking at currently are representatives from the power providing community, representatives from the water community, representatives who have voiced opposition to Project Blue, representatives from organizations such as the Coalition for Sonoran Desert Protection, Watershed Management Group, those types of organizations. If there are any national trade groups associated with data centers who might be able to have somebody that could also provide input on their processes for construction. And then we're also looking at, within the city, our Chief Resiliency Officer, Office of Equity, Emergency Management. These are things we haven't reached out to everybody yet because we really wanted to get your feedback, but that's the list that we're currently working with right now to ensure that we're really establishing a broad advisory committee here. You know, I feel like if we get a committee where everybody doesn't agree, we're doing a good thing because we're getting a diversity of ideas on how to address these. So that's really part of the intent of approaching this list. But that being said, if there's anybody that you believe we should be including and looking at, please let us know because that's very helpful feedback.
I would just add that if you can find somebody locally that, you know, is a data center engineering design person and would understand a comprehensive data center, you know, process and instrumentation diagram for the whole thing.
Commissioner Kenney.
Whatever the process is for approval, I would say that you're going to want to require a development agreement. I think one would probably happen anyway. But I think a lot of the things that we're talking about tonight are probably not appropriate for a zoning code and would be appropriate for a development agreement. So you might as well require it.
That's a really good point. Economic development, be it from the city or from an independent, you know, group. I think one of the things that was that I saw missing from the conversation, I wasn't totally involved with it, was what the city stood to lose economically from not having it. within their city bounds.
I have a question. I was looking into what other cities have done, and I've seen that a bunch of other cities like mandated moratoriums on data centers until their code was written. Is that something we could suggest that mayor and council do, for example, until we have our code written and done?
Commissioner Silva, yes. And actually, I did want to follow up on that comment earlier about the zoning administrator determination. So essentially, we don't have a moratorium right now, but we have almost a de facto moratorium because the zoning administrator has determined that data centers, large-scale data centers, are not allowed by right anywhere in the city. They could only be developed through a planned area development, which is a mayor and council approval that takes several months to propose and go through the review process. So it would be very difficult to build a data center right now. It's only through discretionary processes that it can be built. I did get clarification, Chair Ortiz-Pino, that the Planning Commission as a body does not have the standing to appeal the determination, so it would need to be an individual that appeals that determination. And I did, though, want to clarify just that we do not see that determination as the starting place for this code amendment. So that may have been, you know, that might not have been totally clear in the presentation, but we don't see that determination of a generating energy system as the current classification as the starting point as we are developing the definition moving forward. So we are really looking to define that based on the use and, you know, what we hear from the Technical Advisory Committee and the community in terms of how it should be classified and what regulations are appropriate moving forward.
One more. Oh.
Okay, Commissioner Silva and then Commissioner Lane.
One other thing I was looking at that might be worth looking into, I don't know how complicated it gets, but a lot of cities have also defined them not only as a freestanding structure, but also as a facility within a larger structure. And I think that gets us, like, the dual definition will, like, help us make sure it's addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Going back to what you were just saying, the we're kind of in a moment of limbo, and I just watching what has already happened in our city where it's like there was one site and it was a big, giant thing, and then all of a sudden we heard, well, they're looking at six other places also. So if a regional conversation can't happen immediately, I think I would encourage at least that you and the county are working together on this, and that both of your zoning codes and future building codes are complete in alignment with each other because we're so closely connected to them. So
I do want to add, 2 days ago, we met briefly with the county to discuss this, and we've begun that conversation, and it's been a very fruitful conversation already. So we are continuing to do that.
Okay, yeah, thank you. That would be, I mean, if the two zoning codes were verbatim, that would be really beneficial, I think. Groundbreaking, gosh. Yeah, anyway.
All right, another great discussion.
Transparent. I mean, again, I think I got a little shell shocked from the previous experience that I was in on the other commission, and transparency with our community is really important. And even with the, like, what we just were talking about with the missing middle, I think that the community at large doesn't understand the intent of some of the things we do. And so I don't have suggestions for how, but public education is really, really important. And we, I think, collectively are not doing a good enough job of that. So this is even more, like, the stakes feel a lot higher just based on people's emotions about this. So
I definitely agree with that. And my computer died, so I don't have the schedule ahead of me. But I recall it did feel pretty rushed. We had technical advisory in November, October. We were wanting a code in December with the voting in January. That feels very fast for something like this, that we would want to be transparent and making sure everybody has an educated baseline to move forward on.
Yeah, and Chair Ortiz-Pino and the Commission, I think that timeline is tentative, and it's looking at, you know, having 2 to 3 technical advisory committees going out to the public and then potentially coming back to you in January. But, you know, it depends on how long that conversation has to happen in order to maintain that transparency and make sure that the public is involved. And
I mean, I assume just organizing an attack and setting up bylaws and making sure everybody's involved in schedules for that was going to take a few more months. But would TACs be a notified meeting similar to boards and commissions? Would there be opportunities for public to attend and listen in? Are those closed? What does that look like?
Yeah, so we are still working on that, but I think we were waiting to have this meeting. From this, we're looking to get that set up as soon as we can, and we are hoping to have those meetings in October. But yes, it would be something that we would, while it's not a technical kind of boards, committees, and commissions, like city boards, committees, commission, you know, we would post those agendas, we'd send them out, make sure that we'd send out notification related to those meetings to make sure that the public was aware.
Five potatoes. Okay, so looks like our discussion is done. We look forward to having a second study session, information on the TAC, and lots of more information to come. Yeah. Item number 5, PDC staff announcements.
Well, first, just thank you very much for all of the constructive dialogue and input tonight on these very weighty topics. We really do rely on your input. So thank you to all of you for putting so much time and thought into these conversations. A quick announcement, which is that our department received a few awards at the Arizona Planning Association Conference, which was held last week in Phoenix, one of which was for the community corridors tool that, again, this commission put a lot of thought and time and energy into. So I wanted to let you know that that was honored with the Planning Excellence Award this year from the Arizona Planning Association, and Dan and Elisa were there to receive that award. We also received an award from the APA Arizona Southern Section for the Activate El Presidio project, which was a joint project between the city and Rio Nuevo right here in downtown Tucson to bring streetscape improvements and placemaking to the El Presidio neighborhood. In terms of education, which has been a topic tonight, we are in the midst of very intensive community education on Plan Tucson, which voters will have the opportunity to ratify this fall on your ballot as a City of Tucson voter. That election is November 4th. And Plan Tucson will be Prop 417 on the ballot. So our team has been going out several times a week to neighborhood associations and community groups to share information about Plan Tucson, what's in the plan, and answer questions about it. So all of you are ambassadors to our community. So if any of you are part of neighborhood associations or groups, community organizations that would like a presentation on Plan Tucson, please let us know. And we would be happy to set up a time to present to your organizations about Plan Tucson. And so that is just a couple months away at this point, with ballots going out in early October and the election on November 4th.
Great. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, to you all as well. Thank you.
I mean, y'all did the work. Let's be real. Okay. Item number 6, future agenda items.
Yes. October 15th, we have the public hearing for middle housing. And then in the future, at some point, coming back to you with data centers for those amendments.
Okay, I see one person in our audience. We have a call to the audience. I think I saw you put a card up earlier, sir. And then, okay, so I'll just leave this up to you. You get 5 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes.
Can't hear.
There you go. Ooh, I might be close to this in another 2 months. As I was saying, my name is Jay Tolkoff. I'm a candidate for city council. And my job is to talk to people in Tucson. And I will say that my years of playing rock and roll music when I was younger interferes with my ability to hear a lot what was going on. Some of the things I'm going to bring up, I think were touched on. Excuse me if I'm repeating something that was there. I'm really here to talk about the middle housing issue. I've spoken to hundreds of people about this. The reality is this middle housing thing has become an issue because in May of last year, the legislature decided that they were going to pass HB 2721. And
excuse me, sir, and please correct me. I really apologize here, and I probably should have read this, but this is an opportunity to speak on any subject that is not listed on the current agenda.
Actually,
public hearing. I'm
Commissioner,
sorry.
Speak to the agenda. Commissioner Ortiz Zupino, it's only if it's a public hearing, not a study session. So it's okay.
I'm going to stop reading this altogether. I apologize.
Okay. And I just want to say that the people, somebody mentioned that. I believe it was this commissioner here. You said that a lot of times the public doesn't know what the intent is. This is clearly one of those things. Zoning was established decades ago to protect the integrity of areas of town, protect the value of properties looking forward. And according to the numbers that of contact that the group had, they didn't touch 10% of the public. They didn't touch 1% of the public. According to my numbers, they got about 0.05% of the public that put input into the decision-making process that should have started well over a year ago. I see lots of problems with the middle housing. My big problem is that Tucson is notorious for saying, we're not going to necessarily go by what Phoenix tells us to do. And this seems like it's been an opportunity to take a minimum mandated requirement, and we've blown it up to the point where we're talking about going across the city. The purpose of it is supposed to be affordable housing. I'm sorry? It's not? That's the information that was presented to us, was to create more affordable housing. The Drochman Institute, which was quoted many times, says that that will not happen. And that is truly the elephant in the room. The real thing that I want to know, if it's such a good idea to do this, why did we wait until now? Why didn't we do it a long time ago? I fully believe that the people in Tucson that I'm speaking to think that the best thing to do would be to do this as a minimum and do it as a trial basis, not do this broad brush across a huge area. And as far as the non-compliant 1,600 lots that aren't buildable, well, we've always had the process of being able to rezone stuff and look at stuff on an individual basis. There was a very good point made by one of the commissioners that said, there's lots of areas that this isn't even touching. Well, we can look at those on an individual basis, but the thought of actually going across and making potential changes that could be, which would potentially change the characteristic of Tucson dramatically, and not necessarily to the better, because we don't really know. I implore this group of people to meet the minimum. Let's see how it works. as an experiment and then move on from there. And if you want to take a look at middle housing increases, then I think that it is perfectly within the system to look at it on a piece-by-piece basis, the way we've looked at zoning changes for decades and decades. That's my point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, and I apologize for interrupting.
No problem.
I'll go back to my sheet. All to adjourn.
So,
second.
Third.
Yikes.
I don't know.
Okay, I don't see any hands up. Anybody online who would like to speak on call the audience? Okay. Item number 6-8, call to adjourn.
Good night.
Good night.